Welcome to the Best Ever You Show with your host, Elizabeth Hamilton Garino, CEO and founder of the Best Ever You Network. The Best Ever You Show is here to help you live your life to the fullest. How? Real people, including celebrities, real advice, real places, products and businesses, real life stories. With this radio show, printed magazine, websites, community, and more. And now, here is your host, Elizabeth.
Hello, hello, everybody. How are you today? I hope you're having a beautiful day. It's a gorgeous fall day here in Maine. Couldn't ask for nicer weather. The fog burned off, and there we go, that blue, brilliant sky again with no clouds. It's like a Tahoe bluebird day here in Maine. So I'll take it. Anyway, we have just a cool, I'm going to use the word cool again, because we have just such an amazing guest with us today. He's going to be here for the full hour. His name is Carl Studna. Many of you know him already. You've been emailing me and talking about how excited you are to have him on the show here. And he's the author of the book, Click, Choosing Love One Frame at a Time. And so we're going to spend an hour with him, learn about his life and why he wrote his book and all about his photography. And so let me just tell you just a little bit about him before we bring him on here. Photography comes to mind here when I think of the name Carl Studna. He has photographed some of, I'm going to use the word icon. I think Carl's an icon, but he's photographed Sir Paul McCartney, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Marianne Williamson, Deepak Chopra, George Harrison. We could go on and on and on, and his photographs are so beautiful. Oh my gosh, they're just gorgeous, gorgeous pictures. And so we're going to learn, get a little insight into maybe how he takes his pictures, what he's looking for in the different shots. I know there's some photographers on the line too, so a whole mix of people here with us today, people interested in his book, interested in his photography, interested in him, and just so really excited. Carl, are you, you're there, right? Hello, hello.
I am here, and it's such a pleasure to be with you, Elizabeth.
Thank you. I'm so proud that you're here on the Best Ever You Show. You encompass every single thing that I think about when I think about what I want Best Ever You to be. I look at your website and read your book and everything, and it's just so powerful. What made you, okay, how do you go from being a photographer all these years to writing the book? How'd that happen? Because that's a shift.
Well, that's sort of a lengthy answer, but I'll try and make it more concise. I would say that the message of the book, which is really about how we can choose love in every moment of our lives and using the metaphor of the click of the camera, it was growing in me for many years, that message. I've been a photographer for 34 years. I've specialized in portraits for over 20-some years, and I always learn from every person that's in front of me, in front of the camera, to go deeper with them, within myself, in how to cultivate trust with people. And because I saw that that is one of the key elements that people are looking for, and why most people don't feel comfortable in front of a camera is because they don't feel comfortable, they don't feel trusting usually, there's not a real anchored sense of feeling like you can relax and you can feel safe. So all of that, I began to learn more and integrate more into my sessions. And then I went through a master's program in spiritual psychology where I anchored more in how to really understand that within myself and anchor more clearly in myself in those principles of trust and love and learning lots of skills. And so all of that to say that it brought me into a greater expertise in how to just show up with people and cultivate that loving atmosphere. And then 3-4 years ago, a friend of mine, I'm talking with him on the phone, and he said, he was from New York, and he said, Carl, you need to write a book. And I said, well, tell me more. He said, yeah, you know, you're talking about these principles and all these things that you've been learning, and that just sparked it. And you know how sometimes you hear that a book has been inside of you, or that it's just been waiting, and that's what it was like. And once he opened the door in that way, it all just came flooding out, and all the material came flooding out. And there was a lot to write about here, and it really is, the book is really about how how we choose love in every single moment of our lives, and using the examples, continually going back and forth and using the examples of when we're in front of a camera and being able to use that as a tool for reflecting back when we are in love or when we're in fear.
That's a big thing right there, when you're in love and when you're in fear. And fear is an interesting place. Fear has purpose, but coming from fear all the time is a crazy spot to be in, isn't it? What if that person had said to you, oh, you need to write a book, and you went, oh, I don't know, I'm afraid.
Well, yeah, and then I probably wouldn't have, because I wouldn't have been ready. You know, I think that my understanding is that fear can be so such an undercurrent and so prevailing as something that unless we're aware that it's present, that there's some fearful thought or limiting belief that's present, first we have to become aware of it. And once we're aware of it, then we can start shining light on it and start working through those fears and healing those. So I had to be at a place where I was ready to jump in and say yes to this. So I would say the likelihood is that I probably was not ready because there were too many considerations and fears that were present until that culminating point. You know, so it's very interesting in that way.
Let me ask you another question here. I've got a bunch of them. They're not written down,
sure,
though. They're all in my brain, so I've got to organize them a little bit. I want to go back to, I do this sometimes with guests who have a really long, like, more history to them and things like that of all the different things that you've done. And the reason why I do that with guests is especially for our younger listeners who might be like going, oh, that'd be so cool to be a photographer. Did you know when you were a little kid or, you know, did somebody give you a camera for a holiday or, you know, what was the pivotal moment where you went, hey, you know, I could make this a career, or I like photography, or, I mean, were you like the high school newspaper photographer or anything like that?
Well, I was taking pictures when I was a kid, and I just enjoyed doing it, and I was doing even little 8mm films and things like that. But it wasn't until I took a photography class when I was 16 in 11th grade, and that's when I knew that I had found an art form that I felt could really express things that I was seeing in a unique way, framing things in a unique way, being able to communicate certain messages and things through art that only art can communicate, you know, and I loved it. I just started sharing pictures with people, and people loved them, and I was getting good grades in the classes, and I had a cool teacher, and that really helped, and so I never stopped. It began at that point. I always felt uplifted and inspired by the medium and being able to communicate through that medium, and went on through college and continued to really focus with photography. I was in an art program in college as well, and dabbled in other arts, but you know, I knew that it was either going to be photography or psychology, and because I was really drawn to both, and I really got clear that photography would be, you know, the wisest path for me to take because I was so anchored in it already, and just took that leap of faith and started my business in L.A. in 1979, and stayed with it. And, you know, I always tell young people who are interested in starting out in photography that, you know, of course you have to have the talent. You've got to have the gift, the eye. That's sort of a given. And once that's clear, you know, one of the most other important factors is just staying with something, whether it's photography or whatever. You know, I think in our culture we get so swayed out of fear, different fearful thoughts, thoughts from the community, maybe our parents, from other authority figures that, you know, that we need to have a stable job or do something. You know, all these different thoughts. And
so
I just wasn't
job
willing.
Speech.
Pardon me?
I said the get a real job speech.
Yeah, right, get a real job. Yeah. And yeah. I just wasn't willing to buy into that. Yeah. And so I stayed with it. And it took, it took probably 10 years before I really discovered a niche, which was in the music business, and I was in the right place in California and LA, and because my passion was there, because I loved music, I grew up listening to music. I'm not a musician, but I've always loved music, and I grew up with music packaging, and music packaging was one of the most inspiring forms of photography at first for me that I'd look at when I was growing up. All the beautiful packaging and album covers when there were albums, when they were big, you know, and you could look at these great pictures. Yeah, you know, and they were large.
You said 1979. I'm like, I was born in 1969.
Yeah, right.
I'm like, right. I'm going, age discrepancy. But what I was going to say was, I'm thinking about being a photographer in 1979, and I can remember one of the things that my grandfather gave to me when I was a little pipsqueak was this camera, this Polaroid camera that you clicked it and then you pulled the film out. And then you pulled the thing back, and it was the coolest camera ever, and I still have it upstairs. And I'm wondering, what did the digital camera, how did the digital age and the digital camera change photography for you?
Well, it I think for probably most photographers, it just revolutionized things and making it so much simpler, so many less steps. First, it had to reach a point where I thought that the quality was acceptable. It didn't reach that for me until about 10 years ago. And then when it did, God, I was so grateful, you know, because I didn't have to go to labs. I didn't have to rely on waiting on the costs. I mean, there's so many different things, being able to have immediate feedback. One of the qualities that you lose from digital, which I'm willing to sacrifice because there's so many other positive things, but one of the qualities that you give up is trusting your intuition, because when you were shooting film, you know, you sensed when you had the right picture. You know, in the case of photographing people, you know, you just had a good sense of that moment. I think it allowed you to tap in more to that essential moment. And I talk a lot in the book about what is the essential moment, and that essential moment of when the person is just open and they're awake and they're alive and they're illumined. And so you had to trust your intuition more and sense intuitively when you got that moment. And now with digital, you don't need to do that. You just look, you know, you shoot a few, you might look and say, yeah, I got it. And then you can move on. And there's so many more advantages to that because you don't have to shoot as much. You can see immediately, oh, you've got the expression you want. It's there. And then you can get more variety, and it takes less time. And there's so many wonderful advantages to it. And you know, I had to give up the art. I didn't have to, but I chose to give up the art of being in the dark room, and because I felt like I did master black and white printing in the dark room. And it really is a very unique art form in itself.
Black and white pictures. That's been painful to me. I'm 44, and it's been a strange transition from film to digital, just for me, because I really loved, loading the camera up with film, and you know, I'm not anywhere close. You know, I just like photography and things like that, just an interest. But I love black and white photography, and I took a class in college. And they put you in the dark room, and I don't even know what that class in college would look like now. I'm guessing they don't put you in the dark room to goof up your film.
Some still
and
do.
Turn it purple. Some, and
yeah.
You know.
Some do. Some colleges and high schools now. I think unless it's a private high school that has funding, you know, unfortunately, that's a whole other subject.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Yeah. We've lost. You know, we've lost. If I were growing up today, I'm tangenting from. I'm taking a tangent. If I were growing up today, I don't know whether I would have become a photographer, because photography is not offered in public schools any longer, because the funding's not there. But that's a whole other subject.
Yeah, we'll go back. We'll be here for 2 hours.
I mastered the darkroom, so now the option is really mastering the digital darkroom, and I use Photoshop, And I love it. You know, I learned certain things. I mean, anyone that says they know everything in Photoshop, they're either a genius that is able to learn so quickly or they're lying to themselves, because there's so many programs, so many things in it that you can learn. But I've learned what I want to learn and what I use, and I'm able to, you know, these days most photographers would shoot in color, everything in color, and then transfer to black and white in Photoshop, and you can get phenomenal looking pictures. I believe as beautiful as with film, except film will always have its own unique, what I would consider warmer kind of quality to it than digital does. But
what did you do the first time? What was your reaction and response and thoughts and everything the first time one of your photographs was published, like in Rolling Stone or Time magazine? I mean, really,
it's
got to be the most incredible thing ever.
It was. You know, I just trying to think which was the first time. I think
right.
Probably it might have been some George Harrison pictures I took. Over the course of you know, largely from the late 80s through the 90s, I'm backtracking. I was really, really focused with musicians, and so I had the opportunity to photograph a lot of rock icons like Paul McCartney and George Harrison and Clapton and Rod Stewart, a lot of British icons, Genesis, and tons of British icons. I think because I grew up with them, I was inspired by them, and that's where my passion took me. And I believe that that's really one of the key messages that I've learned, is that when we really follow our passion and what inspires us and don't give up, that is when the connections happen. So consequently, I met the right people. I met the right publications. I hooked up with a singer-songwriter magazine that immediately helped me to build this wonderful portfolio of iconic singer-songwriters, even though I hadn't been doing it that long. So I, you know, one thing led to the next, and then I was hooking up with Warner Brother Records and getting shoots with them for shooting all these largely British icons, and traveling to England and to Japan. And so anyway, the George Harrison shots in Rolling Stone covering his tour of Japan were probably one of the first, and it was so fulfilling because it was in Rolling Stone, and because George Harrison was one of the biggest influences on me, very positive influences in growing up, the Beatles and George Harrison. So yeah, I just felt like you said, you could hang it up. You know, I felt like after I photographed McCartney and Harrison in the same year, there was a part of me that felt, oh, I can just hang it up now. I've done that.
That's funny. But what do you do? And what do you do when you reach that moment? And you're like, holy wow, I'm doing this. And then where do you go from that? Because it seems like you didn't, you know, you kept going and going, and look at all the cool, amazing things that you did following that. I mean, this book is just so awesome. And for people who are just tuning, I just saw a bunch of people kind of join us. We're with Carl Studner, the author of Click, Choosing Love One Frame at a Time. And if you missed the first part of the show, we've been talking about his photography and all the amazing people he's photographed and so forth. And so when you get that feeling, you're like, okay, I'm cool, I'm in Rolling Stone, I photographed certain Time magazine, you know, all that stuff. It's not about being cool, though. It's about something that you're very passionate about that you've done. Can you explain the difference between feeling like you're all that and more and the passion?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I think if we start going into a place of I'm feeling cool and, you know, and wanting and needing that validation, then we're hooked into, you know, needing our ego to be stroked and like looking for something outside ourselves, which there's actually a chapter in the book called Wild Goose Chase, which is all about looking outside ourselves for validation rather than anchoring within, and how do we anchor more deeply within. So the difference, yeah, being that either we're being fueled by our ego and isn't that nice and what can I do next that's cool, or in my case, my attention really has always been on staying tapped into, well, okay, what continues to inspire me, listening within, I happen to meditate, so taking the time to be still each day and listen and ask what's next, what is the next opening for me in my life, how can I be used in the greatest of ways? And that's a huge distinction. So rather than what can I do or what do I need to do next, it's really asking within, how can I be used in the greatest way with the gifts, the unique gifts that I have, and then listening and then following that, because that always leads me to what truly is inspiring for me. And so then I started opening up more to photographing different authors and luminaries that have inspired me over the years through their books and having the chance. The amazing thing with photography and being a photographer in my case is that my interest in photographing many of the people that I have that are known has largely been because they have made a difference in my life and I wish to give back to them. So it's mm-hmm. a form of service as well. So it's listening within, listening within and wanting to give back, really be of service. So when I'm coming from that place and anchored in that place within myself, then the ego is not really present. It's just tapped into how can I be of the greatest service, be a conduit for the unique gifts that I have, honor those gifts, listen to what they are, and then say yes. And sometimes the yes can mean learning more things. In the case of digital, getting back to that, learning more things about digital, learning more technical things. And the irony is I'm not a really technical person. I'm much more of a right brain person. So
you need both.
Yeah, and you have to be both. To have your own business, you have to be both. You have to be methodical, and so I've had to hone and learn hone in with the left brain skills and learn how to operate in the world in that way on many levels in the technical ways. When people are learning photography, and I teach classes sometimes, it's not easy for some people because of the technical aspects of learning photography and the math involved. And I believe I've become a really effective teacher because I teach in the way that I wished that I had been taught when I was a kid, which is very simply and learning. I think there are ways that we can learn that can be taught in a very simple way, as long as the teacher is aware of how to break things down and explain things in a way that people can really understand and relate to.
Who in your lifetime, and you may have more than one or whatever, but do you have an absolute all-time most favorite teacher? Like in elementary school or anything like that? Like, my head goes right to Mrs. Shear. But she passed away. But do you have an all-time favorite? Even if it doesn't have anything to do with photography, I'm just curious if you have an all-time favorite teacher.
Well, I would say that the Dalai Lama is probably continues to be the most influential teacher for me because I spent 5 days in very close proximity with him in 1999 for this peace conference in Dharamsala, India, where he lives. And I got to be around him in very close quarters with a small group of people. And we were all really looking at new paradigms for peace for the new millennium. And I got to witness him being so present and loving and caring with every single person that he was talking with and really taking the time. In fact, when I tell the story where the first day of the conference and I want to get some good pictures of him. He's coming up the path to the Institute, and I run up the path so I can get this perfect perspective as he's walking by me. And he's coming around the bend, and I have my camera up, and he's looking at me. I'm looking through the lens, and I can see he's looking at me, and he's got this huge smile, and like he knows me, like I'm his long-lost friend. And he comes up to me off the path, bows and says hello. And I was so moved and I was so taken, and in that moment I didn't know whether to take the picture or just to be with him in this holy reverence, and I managed to get the picture and be present with him. And but that was the introduction, and it was such a great example of how he sees everybody that way. We're all special. It's not that, oh, I was special. I am, and so is everybody else. And he sees and recognizes everybody as being special in that way. And that is such a beautiful quality. I mean, imagine every person that we see. It's hard to imagine because, you know, we protect ourselves as we're walking around in the world. But, you know, imagine every person that you see and you're looking at each other and seeing, oh, you're the most special person in the world. So that was my introduction
world
to him.
If we thought about who's the nicest one or something crazy like that. And it's interesting. You went there, and I went to Mrs. Shear, and that's probably one of the key reasons why I went to Mrs. Shear. She loved everyone. I don't know. You could have been not sitting still or doing whatever you were doing, and she was just such a great teacher like that. Really peaceful, really the one who said she looked at me and she said, "You're gonna be a writer." Like, I am, I? 10. She looked at me and said, "You're going to be a writer." And she's like, you write for me the whole year. You write. Just write, you can write whatever you want. Just write. And I still remember I took the 3 Mexican jumping beans and made them have a conversation in the middle of a table. And I remember her smile on her face. And her laughter, but I made that, you know, I personified them and gave them a conversation. And she looked at me like, "You should write more." So it's amazing. Why I'm going there for a minute is because not everybody can just go meet the Dalai Lama, you know. And so do you think it's important in our lives to find who gives us that feeling of joy and peacefulness?
Absolutely. I feel that one of the most important ways that we learn is through positive examples and role models. Actually, it's one thing to read in a book, which is wonderful, which is great and effective, to read in books about embodying qualities and how to open to, you know, those qualities within ourselves. And there's something, it's a whole different perspective and level when we either meet personally or see in the media, see on television or films, positive examples of people that are actually living and embodying those qualities, and especially for young people. You know, I think young people today more than ever are so needing to see, you know, really positive role models that are reflecting back and teaching, you know, values that are really from the heart and from being true and being authentic and being of service and following, trusting in our unique gifts. And you know, I could go on and on about that.
Yeah, but I could too. It's a class I hope one day that they teach in school even. You know, just even if it started there as part of the curriculum or something, just to start to talk more. They do a pretty good job of something fairly close. It touches on it. It doesn't go deeply into it. But here in Falmouth, Maine, they, you know, they teach the role model, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I wish kids would actually have a, like, almost like a class in high school or something, even younger. Be so cool if it was part of the curriculum of, and I don't know, just I could go on and on there too. But anyway, those are my things.
When I was, you know, in my, especially in my 30s into my 40s, that I was seeing a lot was Ram Dass, the teacher Ram Dass, author. And I have pictures, there's 4 pictures of him in my book that I sort of devote the center section to him, because he, to me, is such an instrumental teacher for me in just really tapping into being what it means to be authentic, to be in the moment, to honor our true gifts and our true self.
A lot of wise people out there. It's pretty,
yeah,
pretty neat. And do you think you have to, let's see, how do I want to ask this? How do you start to live aware or live a little bit more conscious of what you're doing or be mindful or Do you think you just start and sort of decide to do that one day? Or, you know, it's interesting to me because a lot of people, you know, we're creatures of routine and habit and all these
things. That's right.
What do you think it means to step back and think about even what you eat or do or say or, you know, I'm kind of the opinion that time's a pretty precious commodity and it's limited in some sort, you know, and how you spend your time. Like, for example, today I find it amazing and loving and kind and everything that we're spending an hour together. It's an hour of your life and an hour of mine.
That's right.
And it's mindful. It's to help people. It's to, you know, do all these amazing things. It's to meet each other. It's to, you know, what do you think about that? I mean, how do you start living a little bit more aware? I noticed you're on the Transformational Leadership Council, and your book is filled with gems of, you know, how to do this. But if you were to give people advice today, it can be the Carl Studna advice. What would you say to help people do that? To be a little more aware.
Sure. Well, first off, I would encourage that we just do an assessment of our life and just look at like a life assessment and look at, well, ask certain questions initially, like, well, do I feel inspired in my life? And if the answer is no, then there's further questions from there. Then what, you know, what inspires me? What ignites me in my life? And continue. It's like you start asking one question and it unravels to the next question. And but for me, so much of it has to do with asking the questions. We so often, I believe, in our culture, we're so caught up in the busyness and the doingness and feeling like we have to get things done. Obviously we do. I mean, we have obligations and we have commitments and timelines for things. And that being said, we also have the freedom to choose. So that one of the first things is just recognizing I have the ability to choose to think differently, to ask different questions than I've been asking, and to step back. So that's the first thing, is to recognize that we have that ability to step back and start asking different questions than we've been asking and entertaining different thoughts than we've been thinking. And then once we do that, then there can be a whole series of questions that we ask ourselves and take those into the stillness. I'm a strong believer in meditation, and if you don't relate to the word meditation, you know, you can call it just being still, allowing the mind to slow down, taking time to just rest and listen within, and even ask certain questions like what is it that inspires me? Make a list of what inspires you. Another question you can ask is, what qualities do I feel best reflect who I am in my life? So, in other words, when I'm out in the world, what qualities really reflect the essence of who I am? So if someone were to meet me and start to get to know me, what would they see in me? All right, so they might be, qualities could be compassion and presence or love or joy or playfulness or whatever they are, and writing those down. So once we start getting clear about the qualities that inspire us and the qualities that really, those traits that really embody who we are in the world, then that can really help us to start honing in on how to best rest in those qualities more from moment to moment in our lives. And that's part of what I practice through this practice of mine called the Luminescence Method. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did you come up with that? Because that's really interesting. And we were talking about moments mattering, and I love this. Show up and shine. You wrote, what's this mean? Like, you said, show up and shine not only in front of the camera, but in every moment, in every moment choice point of life. That's beautiful.
Yeah. Well, how I came up with it was seeing that as I was growing in the way that I was being with people and photographing people, that I was recognizing that what I was really doing beneath the surface was reflecting back to people their light. You know, we use the word light all the time. You know, we'll say lighten up, or you look bright today. You know, there's all these terms for using the word light. And what I really believe and what I see is that when, and I'm going to use the metaphor of when we're in front of a camera, when we're having our picture taken, but this really applies, I think, to every moment of our lives. So what I see when someone's in front of a camera is either how bright their light is shining or not, or dim. And I believe that when it's dim, it's because there are fears that are present. And the fearful thoughts, those energies, those vibrations, lower the light. They lower the expression. Light shows up as openness, as trust, as willingness, as just being present in the let go, in the yes. And you see it in people's eyes. Their eyes are open. You know how some portraits you can look into, and it looks like you're looking into the people's eyes, into the depth of who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That I believe is because that's when they're open, and that's when their light is fully activated. So luminescence to me is really about lumen meaning light, you know, and essence being our essence. So when the light is fully infused in our essence and fully activated, that is when we are open, that's when we're ignited, that's when we're inspired, that's when we are in touch with our gifts, in touch with our qualities, that's when we're on track and on target in our lives, and that's, I believe, when we are really out there and being the full force, full boogie expressions of who we are, of our God-given gifts, and how we can fully express, you know, the full embodiment of our uniqueness.
Now, when somebody, I'm going to go to the dark for a minute.
Sure.
And I hate being in the dark, but I'm going to be in the dark for a little bit, just a minute here.
Sure.
Get me out of here again. No, but you know how when someone sits down sometimes, and I've been here before, where you sit down and somebody needs to take your picture or wants to take your picture or you need your photo taken or whatever the case is, and you're sitting there going, oh, my God, I feel fat, I feel old, I feel, whoa, you know, whatever, you know, whatever is running through, you know, a lot of people think they don't want their picture taken. They don't like their teeth or their eyes or their hair. I'm sure you have come across that. We are so hard on ourselves when it comes to having our picture taken. I have a question for you about who took your picture. That's one thing. I was curious who you let take your picture for your book cover. But also on the other side of that's the light. The dark of this question is, how do you deal with that? And what advice do you have for people? You know, because I'm maybe one of the few people who feels completely blessed to age. I'm not stressing about it. I'm like, cool, the alternative sucks. So I'm really good with my wrinkles, you know. And so, like, I won't let people airbrush a picture of me. I won't let them clean up my teeth. I won't let them do anything. This is me. But I'm told that's rare.
It is. So how I deal with that? So let's say someone comes in. I'll give you an example. I wrote about it in the book. There's a woman, I called her Mary in the book, and it was for a corporate shoot I was doing, and there were all these people that were lined up to do these corporate sessions, quick, you know, 15, 20-minute sessions with me back-to-back in this office. And she came in because she was forced to come in. This is like an ultimate example of this. It wasn't her, quote, choice. She had to for the company. And she was terrified because she grew up in a traumatic environment for her. She felt it was traumatic. Her father was a professional photographer, clearly not sensitive, always having her pose for stuff, having her do stuff that she didn't want to do as a kid. And she had, you know, on the scale from 1 to 10, 10 being the highest trauma, she had the highest. And she was like a wounded, you know, like wounded animal, hurt animal coming in. Mm-hmm. And everything about her was closed down. Her face was so tight. And anyway, I could immediately see it because you do.
You do. You see that.
You see it.
Pictures or not. Yeah, you come. You see that every day.
Right. So she's an ultimate example. So I see it, and I ask her. I mean, and this is all in 15, 20 minutes. And I ask her, first off, I provide a trusting atmosphere. Okay, and that's one of the key elements is how do we show up, whether it's as a photographer taking someone's picture or just being with someone. How do we show up and just be cultivate such a sense of love and reflect back light, reflect back truth, reflect back knowing that that person at their core is perfect and whole and wise and beautiful and, you know, just grace-filled.
Yeah, amazing.
You know,
how do we
do that? And that's a lifelong process. And I continue to open to how to show up in that way, because when we are able to show up and just simply reflect back light, and that's what I was getting to before, mm-hmm. light, it's a principle. It's a principle in physics. It's a principle in quantum physics. Darkness cannot reside in light. So if our light, and we're reflecting it back so strongly to somebody, if we bring the light in so strongly and are able to reflect that back and continue to hold that and reflect that and know that and be with that person and send them the love in such beautiful ways through our words, through our ways of being, through things that we say, if we continue to hold that so deeply, like cradling a young child, then the person can feel safe. And that's what I witness always. Sometimes more than others, but in her case, if I had been with her for an hour, I would have had even a greater sense of result as far as her really fully opening. But in that 20 minutes, she let go enough for me to get a okay picture. Wasn't fantastic, but it was okay. But it was a healing for her, and I wrote about it because she said to me, "This is like being in an amazing therapy session."
It's almost like therapy. It's energy, isn't it? It's moving energy around and giving and giving some of your beautiful energy to another human being who might not feel so well. Kind of the same thing with you said kind of like scared animal kind of thing. I love my cats. My cats are all shelter cats, and I adopt cats, and it's kind of like that too. And like one of the I don't mean to exactly equate a person with a cat or anything like that, but you know what I want to say is I have this cat upstairs and it's terrified. It's absolutely terrified. And when I first brought her into the house, and my son and I, our cat passed away, so we adopted another cat, and we wanted to pick up a cat that we knew would never be adopted. We just knew that the cat would never ever be adopted. You just know when you spend time with them. And we decided to do that. And the first day in the house, the cat, and what I love about this cat, too, is no matter how scared it was, it never hissed, scratched, did anything. It just was scared. And so we brought the cat in, and the first day here, it was shaking. I mean, literally shaking. And now it's been with us for about 4 months or so. And the cat meows and loves food again and sleeps on my son's bed. I mean, just the transition with love applied.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, enough, bringing in enough love and trust and safety, I believe, you know, over time can heal anything. It can heal anything.
Yeah, and we say to the cat, you're going to be okay. It's all good. You know, we go in the room, we put our voices different. We're like, you love, you know, you're sweet. We hug her and everything. And, you know, we do all these things. And I think probably a year from now, this cat will be a completely different cat.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So bringing it back to, you know, the camera, you know, I talk in the book, the introduction and the first chapter are all about, well, why is it that 85% of the people that come and see me feel like they hate having their picture taken or they don't take a good picture. I examine that, and I look at that because I consider that we in Western culture have a dysfunctional relationship with having our picture taken. And so why is that? So I look at that. You know, I look at myths that I feel are present. I look at dysfunctions that I feel are present. And one of them that I'm going to throw out to everybody now as sort of a tool and an encouragement for everyone that's listening, and some people might choose to try it, is that when you're taking someone's picture, whether it's a friend or if you happen to be a photographer and you're taking portraits of someone, anyone that's picking up a camera to take someone else's picture, I assess that you have a responsibility. If you want the person to feel relaxed, if you want to take a good picture of someone, then it's a co-creative process. It's not just picking up a camera and telling someone to smile, or in the old days saying cheese. You know, it requires a responsibility on your part to be co-creative, to be a part of that process. Just like if you're around someone and they're not in a good mood or they're feeling self-conscious or scared, what are you going to do? You know, you're going to encourage them to open up. You're going to provide a trusting environment. You know, you're going to be compassionate. So I'm not saying it has to be a therapy session, but you can even just do things like simple things that I often do, which is just, in my case, sometimes it's being silly. So I'll just be silly with people, and you know, and I'll do something like, you are looking, and I'm being silly, and it's like, oh man, this is the moment right now. Right now, you're looking so fine. Right now, the beauty is coming out. The light's coming out. You're shining. I feel it. I see it in you. Oh, it's incredible.
I love
you know? Yeah. So how can people not, you know, most people just let go? And you're engaging. Now, obviously, many of you aren't going to feel like you're going to do that. You're hearing me go, well, I'm not going to do that. But you can do something, you know. Just discover something that you, how you can be and what you can say that's going to lighten someone up or get someone to have a natural smile if you want to smile for somebody. So it's a co-creative process. We've gotten into this habit since who knows when, maybe the 40s when cameras started to be portable and you could actually do snapshots, you know, where we got into this dysfunctional habit of just expecting that someone could just stand there and you say smile and not expect anything from them, and it's unrealistic.
Yeah. You have one of the only pictures I've ever seen of Dr. Michael Bernard Beckwith not smiling. I'm just starting to know him over the past few years, so you know him much, much longer than I do, I'm sure. And my experience with him is everything smiling. It's one of my and I love this picture. I mean, I absolutely love this picture, and I love his smile too. I mean, I think he has got one of the coolest smiles ever. He smiles through the computer. And I told him that one time when I got to interview him. He's so cool. Why did you pick a picture of him not smiling?
Well, that's a really good question, because that picture, and there's another one in the book of Deepak Chopra, both of those came through what I call inner visions. And this happens sometimes. I was talking earlier about in a meditation of mine. I've known Michael for like 25, 27 years. And so in a meditation, he and his wife, Ricky, were coming to Denver, and they were actually going to be staying with us. So I knew I had the opportunity, if he was open to it, to do some pictures of him. And so I just had this vision in my meditation of the shot that's in this book. And it's a profile, and there's a red background, and it's backlit, and it's very kind of moody looking. And it looks like a very prayerful shot where he's in deep contemplation. And I just had the very vivid vision of it in this meditation. So I emailed him the next morning and said, okay, this vision came in my meditation, so I think we need to do it. And how could he say no? I mean, I've learned he's been a great teacher of mine as well, and he's one of the first to honor when we have inner visions, you've got to act on them. So he said yes, and the picture came out identical to the inner vision. And that happens whenever I have that kind of inner vision in, when I'm in the stillness. The same with Deepak as well, where in the inner vision I saw the message that came through is he's a messenger of light. And then the physical picture that illustrated that is him holding with, like in the palm of cupping his hands, this candle, and it's illuminating him. And so sometimes that happens as well, where the visions will come visually so clearly, and then all I have to do, and I assess this is true with all of us when we trust and we follow them, that all I have to do is take the steps to allow it to unfold. With Deepak, it took a lot longer because I didn't know him, and I had to took about 3 years to continually plant the seed with his assistant, and then when he was coming out to Denver, it finally unfolded, and it happened, and it came out again, identical to that inner vision. So trusting, when we have these inner visions, whether it's for obviously a photograph or for a career opportunity, anything, when they're clear, when they're coming from that clear, receptive place that we just know and we feel is right, just to trust that and to listen to what the steps are that we need to take to allow those to unfold.
Yeah, you have his. I love this picture. You have his. He's got a glow. That's the backlighting, I'm guessing. But it's him too. I mean, he just has a glow about him. Now, when you take Michael Beckwith's picture, does he sit there and go, "Is my hair okay?" Or does he?
No,
like
no,
that?
He doesn't.
I don't
he could care less.
No,
he could care less. Then I have to be aware of that. Yeah. No, Michael's not thinking at all about any of that. No, it's
just thought I'd ask, just in case, you know, if there's a side to Michael that, you know. And how did, okay, so this, the picture of the Dalai Lama, the picture is so close. Is he really that close to you, smiling like that with his hands outreached to you?
That's how close he was, yeah.
That
was the story I was telling. And he was just a foot, you know, just a foot from me, bowing. Yeah.
What a cool career and life and everything you have. Now, can we go over to the psychology part a little bit? Because you have a master's degree in spiritual psychology.
Yeah.
So not only are you this amazing photographer and you have all this light about you, and I love your sense of humor too. Thank goodness you have a sense of humor. I'm wondering when I interviewed you, I'm like, please have a sense of humor. It scares me when people don't. But anyway, what about the spiritual psychology? And were you ever at a point where you're like, oh, I think I'll do this instead? Or was it just complementing what you were doing? Or before, or what, I don't know the time frame.
Yeah, I would say it was complementing. I really didn't take the program of the 2-year master's program. I didn't do it thinking that I was going to switch careers. I took the program because I really, well, first off, my wife, Cynthia James, had gone through it right before me, and I had witnessed the amazing program that it was and all of the things that she was learning, and I loved the whole feel and approach of it, which was really learning. Yeah, you're learning hundreds of counseling tools and techniques, but it's so experiential too, and I'm an experiential learner, and the whole program was based in experience, and really, I wanted to be more free in my life. I wanted to open up and lighten up more and let go of any remnants of fear, fearful thoughts, fearful patterns that I had still been holding on to. So that was my primary motivation, was so that I could lighten up more and be more free, and then be freer to be of service to others, because I do believe that the freer that we feel, then the greater that we're able to be more expressive and to give our gifts in more unabandoned ways and see what they are, expand with our gifts more, the freer that we are. So the program really, really helped me to let go of old limiting beliefs and patterns and become more open and authentic and less fearful and be able to shine the light more and be more of service. And it was, I tell people, it was out of any experience I've ever done. It was because it was a 2-year, very committed devotional program to yourself. You had to take a lot of time off from everything else you're doing, and that was why it took me so long to realize I was ready to do it, because I didn't trust that I could take enough time that it took away from my business. But when the calling's there, you know, the calling came in a meditation the day after my wife graduated. Calling came and said, "You've got the time." And once I heard that and trusted that, I called that next morning and signed up. And
awesome.
And it was truly the most valuable, life-changing experience of my life, and the greatest experience that I'm the most grateful for being able to apply, just how to be more present with others and really give the fullness of my gifts. So it was amazing.
Yeah, I keep thinking about maybe doing something like that, only I've got 4 teenage boys and one in college, so I can't picture being in college the same time my son's in college, although I wonder if they just snapped it. Mom's going back. But I do think about that a lot. Now, you mentioned your wife a few times. Do you want to talk a little bit about her? Does she not like being talked about on the radio?
Oh, no. Sure, I'm happy to talk about her. Yeah. Cynthia James, she has been a huge inspiration for me as well. She is a coach, inspirational speaker, singer, was an actress and professional singer in LA for many years, and she's quite inspirational. She's quite an amazing life.
You're at loss for words. It's awesome. She must be cool. I love it.
It kind of complements the other question you asked me earlier, was who took the picture of me on my album, my book, and she did. She's actually, and I don't mean this from an ego place, but she's learned certain things from me as far as tools. You know, I'd be there with her, and I set up the lighting and everything, because that's something that I'm being much more attuned to, the location and the lighting. But you know, we get it all set up, and she's there with me, and she's saying things to me that I would say to others, but in a very clear and authentic way. Like, okay, let go now and breathe. Yeah, you breathe, and let yourself fully let go and breathe, and you let your eyes relax and open, and you're just sort of anchoring and open to the fullness and letting go of any concern or tension that's there. So she was able to reflect that back to me in that picture and others that I've had taken as well. But she's awesome. I'm always learning from her, and I'm grateful to have a marriage that I feel like we're both able to learn things from each other and support each other in our greatest of gifts and upliftment.
Now, how long have you been married?
We've been married 14 years. We've been together 18, and which was a huge record for either of us. And it was a big record, you know. When I met her, it was the universe was saying, and now for something completely different, you know, because I needed something different than the path I had been going down
now
before.
Now for something completely different, yeah. So I have too. I've been married for 14 or 15 years, and same thing. Just awesome. We've got 90 seconds left, and I'm wondering if we could end on this question, and we can run just a few minutes over, but not a half hour over or anything like that. But you photograph a lot of couples in all stages of love. What about those ones who've been together like for 50 years? I'm fascinated by. I've got a couple of people that I've met on Best Ever You, through Best Ever You, that have been married like 47 years, and my parents have been married over 40 years, and I'm just fascinated. What do you think about? What do you know? Are there any differences you notice in people that have been married that long when you take the picture?
Oh God, I could talk about this for a long time, but I'll try.
Sorry,
and hone.
I'll open up the can of worms. Yeah.
I'll hone. Okay, so I did a book, it hasn't been published yet, on couples of all ages, all ethnic backgrounds, lengths of time together from blossoming love to 50 years together. And the common element that I found with all the couples, because they were all interviewed too, was that the common element was how they anchored trust with each other. So trust was the key commonality that all of them learned to find ways of going deeper in their trust. With the couple that was together 50 years, this one couple, Carla and Walter, they were the most inspiring because I interviewed them three times, actually twice and then once with Carla after Walter passed. And there was what I witnessed with them, and this was really a huge insight for me, was that it wasn't that they were unconditional with their loving for each other, meaning that they could accept it. But it didn't necessarily mean that it always looked, oh, yes, I accept that from you. It didn't look all you know, rosy all the time. I mean, they'd be in an interview, and they might be bickering even a little bit about something. But I could see that underneath the bickering, that the commonality was that they found a way to just love and unconditionally accept the things that they might not relate to for themselves. Like Carla, they lived off the shore in Honolulu, and Carla was a free spirit, and she would still go off into the bay. She was, you know, without clothes on, you know, and she'd walk around their grounds there, you know, without clothes. And Walter would say, you know, I don't, you know, he, bottom line, he'd say, I don't relate to it, but yeah, I accept her doing that. I can get to a place where I accept that and love her anyway. I love her beyond my even understanding of that. And that to me was a huge aha. It's just, and I apply that in my relationship too, is that there might not be things that I necessarily relate to at times, but learning to honor the differences in ways that are, you know, that sometimes even might even rub me the wrong way. But learning to honor them anyway, because we are unique and we're all working through our stuff, and how to just continue to open and honor the person for exactly who they are. And that doesn't mean not having conversations and looking at ways to, if things need to get resolved, of course, but other, like other traits and things that sometimes, you know, could either you know, drive you away or learning to just go, you know, finding that inroad for loving and trusting that person's path for exactly how they are and who they are. And that's been a, yeah.
Yeah. I always say, oh, that's the worst I've got to deal with. Okay, I'm good.
Right.
Whatever. You know.
Yes.
You want to run around the block naked, you go for it. You know, I'm good with it. You know, whatever. I hear you. But, you know, the, okay. So, yeah, I was going to talk just a tiny bit about my parents. My parents have been married for 40 years. And the other part, I think the other part of that is when you're married for that long, you're not always well. You know, my dad's a stroke survivor since 2004. And so for the past many, many years, my dad's now a kidney cancer survivor as well. You know, he didn't ask for it, and they certainly didn't ask for it. And I think my parents are to be studied, I swear. I write about them in my book a lot. And because they have this just amazing way of, I don't know even what to call it. I talk to my mom and dad about it a lot, but they maneuver through. You know, I'm in the middle of 11 kids. You know, their life has been filled with just about everything you can think of. I think they've seen and done it all, and they're both about 70 now. And their ability to deal with stuff is fascinating.
Yeah.
It's absolutely fascinating. And they're both drop-dead beautiful.
Mm.
I mean, they're very beautiful. They're in every way. And they are the ones who have taught me never give up.
Yes. Yeah, and that's such a beautiful, Yes, Elizabeth, and that's such a beautiful example, you know, because I was talking about in terms of career earlier, but applying that to relationship as well, you know, about never giving up. I mean, obviously, there's obviously that if you're in a relationship and it's abusive and it's just clearly not right, then that's a whole different story. But if the love is there and the values are there, you know, learning, you know, I think that there's such the opportunity. I mean, that's what that's one of the key things I've continued to learn in my relationship, and I found in the couples I photographed that have been together a long time, is that learning, I'm watching this tree bending with the wind, and that's, and there's some Buddhist metaphors that talk about that as well, you know, where you watch trees. I'm watching it right now. It's just so perfect. Mm-hmm. I'm watching this tree as the wind is blowing, and it's just bending with it. And that's what I see, that we have the opportunity to learn and to grow into more with our intimate relationships, partnerships, is learning how to bend more with the wind, whether it's with illness or with any financial times, hard times at all, anything. Mm-hmm. And that can only strengthen our character, it strengthens our soul, it strengthens us as individuals. Gosh, it's just, I think that there's such potential that our generation, the younger generations have now, because that's one thing that our grandparents' generations and some of our parents' generations had, and going back, where they stayed together no matter what. And sometimes that might have not been too pretty, but in many cases, there was this case of strengthening of character and learning more about yourself through how you are with the other person, and how to grow in compassion and understanding and reflection through relationship. And it can be such a phenomenal experience if we stay open and learn how to communicate with our partner, and how to get in touch with our feelings and really express ourselves and be authentic. And man, I mean, anyway, I could go on and on and on. But
yeah. Well, I promise not to keep you though. So, any final thoughts? Because we're over, and I promise that I wouldn't. But what a joy speaking with you and getting to know you. And I want to go through your book one more time. We also have somebody, there are a number of people listening, but there's a chat going on, and Tony Scruggs, the baseball player, says hello to you and to both of us.
Oh, hi.
And he has very much enjoyed this conversation. So he's a former pro baseball player, and he's with
beautiful.
Us listening. And thank you very much for listening. We appreciate you being with us for the show. And I don't know, anything else? I'll end on your book and website, and then you can chime in. But click Choosing Love One Frame at a Time, and your website is carlstudna.com. Anything you want to say?
I'll end by saying how the subtitle of the book, Choosing Love One Frame at a Time, is truly what I feel is the opportunity that we have in every moment of our lives to open, to experience how we can stay open and allow the essence of our light and our love and our truth and our wisdom and our message to fully be out there and be giving it in its fullest of capacity. And I feel and I know that all that are listening and everyone out there has that ability to just trust, to anchor more deeply, allow and say yes in every single moment, and watch those miracles continue to unfold, and watch our lives expand in ways beyond our wildest imaginings.
Absolutely beautiful. Thank you for your time. And thank you, Elizabeth.
It's been, such a pleasure.
Thank you.
Oh, I've loved our time together. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I have too. Just a true joy. So thank you very much to everyone listening, and thank you again, Carl. Tomorrow on the show, we have Esther Nicholson joining us. Really excited. Another really exciting conversation. Lots to learn. We've had three very wise guests. Lots to learn. There are some really good books, people, experiences, and all these shows, they help us be our best. So I hope you're tuning in. And if you have any questions, please let me know, and I'll pass them on to Carl. And thank you so much. Take care, everyone, and have a beautiful day. Thank you, Carl.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Best Ever You Show. Want more? Visit us at besteveryou.com. Be your best and keep it real. Confident, successful, caring, and beautiful every day with Best Ever You.